Hello and welcome back to the official Scottish Rugby Podcast. On this week's show, we discuss the Rugby World Cup 2019 for Scotland, the Guinness Pro 14 and Super 6. We're back from Japan. We're not even in Edinburgh yet. We're in Glasgow, the home of Glasgow Warriors, here at Scotstoun. How are we, gents?
Good, thanks, Jamie. Very good. As you say, back from Japan. I know we'll touch on it a bit later. Brilliant trip. Rugby, from a Scotland point of view, disappointing finish. Credit to Japan, not only for that performance, but for the way they put the whole tournament on. It's been incredible, and we've got one big game still to go.
You went out, came back, went out again. How was the travel for you? How did you find it?
Travel's the worst part of it, but yeah, we were all out in Nagasaki for a week beforehand in the holding camp, and that was probably that was up there for the best part of the trip for me. There was so much happening, and I heard you saying earlier on, Jamie, actually, there was no pressure of games, even from a non-playing point of view. It was an opportunity to take in the country, but yeah, all in all, it was an enjoyable trip, but as I say, disappointing with the rugby.
And Mossy, you were out doing some commentary for ITV. How long were you out for? A couple of weeks you were there for?
No, I was there for 5 weeks. Oof. So Scottish Rugby's first week, working with the kind of off-field stuff and all the support we gave around the squad and school visits and coaching and the kind of ambassador stuff, as well as working with the players, the kickers on the field. And then once the competition started, I covered 11 games, or 10 games actually. One was cancelled because of the typhoon, but 10 games for the World Feed for World Rugby. Co-coms on 11 games, which is amazing, and jumped in and out with the kickers throughout the 5 weeks or the 4 weeks of the competition. So amazing place, amazing people, brilliant World Cup, and some of my strongest memories are from the games that Scotland didn't play in, just being part of some of the just incredible skills and some of the events that they were lucky enough to be commentating on.
What was the highlight? What was the big game that you, or the game that stands out for you then, that you worked on?
I think it would have to be Ireland versus Japan. I did the first New Zealand South Africa game, which was quite interesting. Actually, I thought that would then go on to be the final, but it was just like a 7 minute window where New Zealand scored 14 points or 17 points, and then so games like that. There was other games like France USA, some of the way France played early parts of that. There was a whole spectrum of games, the Scotland games obviously, but the one that sticks out as a World Cup experience that I don't think I'll ever be part of again was the Ireland versus Japan game, where Japan were 14 points down. It's in Shizuoka, so it was 60,000 people, and then the ability of their defence got them back into a game, and in the last 5 or 10 minutes was just mind-blowing, really. Good memories.
When did you watch that game? You didn't go to the game, did you? You were in Yokohama, were you?
Yeah, I was in Yokohama at the time. As Chris says, it was an incredible game of rugby. I was lucky enough to be at the South Africa-New Zealand game, Chris was working and doing the comms. I was just there enjoying it. A couple of those games stand out as well, because you're sitting watching the game as a fan. Like, there's no skin in the game. I didn't really mind who won that game of rugby, who was to come out on top. So you enjoy it a lot more than you do when you're sitting watching your own team. So that was nice to be part of. How did you get on with the food, Chris?
Good.
Don't tell lies.
It grew on me. I love Japan. Some of the food was outstanding. Some of it I wouldn't go near where he wouldn't get me close to. But once you've been there a wee while, you know what's what, yeah. You find what you like, and absolutely brilliant. By the end of it, I was still almost eating like a local.
Any guilt in the fact that we went out a few times for dinner, and we took kind of TGI Fridays one night?
It's about balance, isn't it? It's about getting the right balance.
Stick to what you know, though.
Once you know, because it's completely alien, isn't it? Like, yeah. A lot of the menus, a lot of what you're eating, like, you just try, trial and error. And once you understand what it is and what it's like, some of the food was absolutely amazing. And
did you take on the curries for breakfast? Have you been having your rice and chicken curry?
No, I'm a fruit man at breakfast time.
You're a cocoa pops man.
What? as well as fruit, yeah. And I'm not a hot breakfast man, but some of the food was amazing. Some of it, I was like, there's no way I'm going near that.
I agree with
but,
you.
But what a place, what a country, what a World Cup.
He sent me a message during that when he had moved on to his new hotel, and it was Cocoa Pops on this little twisty thing that you could get at the breakfast bar. I don't think he'd been happier the whole time he was there.
Job comforts, Jamie.
with Japan in general, we were all fortunate to be involved in that World Cup. It was clear to see that not just the areas we were in, but the whole country was invested in this World Cup. You can clearly see how much it meant to them to host this World Cup. But you look at the team on the pitch, were you guys surprised at how well they performed and how well they did in the tournament?
Oh, it's easy to say now, I wasn't surprised. You know, you look at that Ireland game and the signs were there. I undoubtedly, before the tournament, you looked at that last group game for us, that Japan-Scotland game, and you knew it was going to be massive. I believe we were good enough to win that game. So, although I suspected Japan would be good, I thought we'd be better. And on the day they turned out, they put in an incredible performance, especially in that first half, and got themselves into that lead. Japan were always going to be a good team. Yeah, I mean, in all honesty, you've got to put your hands up and say you're surprised at how good they were, because it wasn't just one style. Chris mentioned their defence there. They were doing so many things well.
I wasn't surprised at how they played, but I was surprised by their ability to defend like they did. I mean, their attack has always been built on the same kind of basic execution, being, you know, really, really good, a fast tempo, brilliant skill set. But where they've struggled is just competing physically. And we lost out physically in the opening game against Ireland. And that was the second game for Japan winning against Ireland. And I saw how we struggled with Ireland's physicality. And, you know, in the lead up to the game, all I could see was Ireland grinding down Japan because of their attack's great, their defence is great, but a good big one will usually beat a good wee one in many ways, for you, sir, a more simpler explanation. But it was just the ability of the defence to force Ireland into making errors. So Ireland's physical game after the first couple of tries couldn't get going, and then they tried to play a game that didn't suit them. They tried to offload. They were chasing the game when they were ahead, Ireland, and that was through just the physicality and the bravery of the Japanese. So I wasn't surprised at how they played, but I was surprised at their ability to just repeat effort after effort after effort against good opposition.
I would chuck that into that repeat effort. Japan is the rugby they play is incredibly high energy, and probably the biggest surprise for me was that they were able to maintain that over the whole group stages. Every single game they played, they brought their best game. They emptied themselves on that park. It's difficult to back that up week on week. For me, their levels of fitness, as well as their levels of rugby ability, their levels of fitness were incredible.
I think most teams will be as fit as each other, though. I think there's individual. I reckon all the individuals will be supremely fit, but their team fitness, is in terms of how quickly your team play, kind of dictates what your fitness looks like. You know what I mean? I don't believe there'll be an unfit player at the World Cup. The way science is, the way coaching is, and the preparation that goes in, but the way that Japan play suits their team fitness, but you still have to front up week on week against bigger opposition and match them physically, overcome them physically, and do it again. Now, the scheduling helped. They had 4 weeks to play 4 games, or, you know, 4 weekends and 4 games. So that does help. But, yeah, I would have said that everybody's fit, but they just, on a wave of support and emotion, kicked them on a wee bit. They weren't that far off South Africa, if you think of what South Africa did. South Africa dominated that game, as weird as it sounds. But it took until, 60 minutes, really, to pull away a wee bit. And you see what South Africa have done to other teams, and they're not far off.
Yeah, we'll come on to South Africa a little bit later on, because there's still a big game this weekend, the final against England. Big game on the Saturday.
Big game tomorrow night as well. We should talk about that one.
Yeah, third place playoffs. That's an interesting topic, that one. It's only right that we look at ourselves as well. I think we're all in agreement. We were all disappointed to come home early. Scotland didn't get out of the group stages, only for the second time in their World Cup career. We've had time to think about and mull over Scotland's performance in the World Cup. What can you guys take away from the 2019 tournament?
So, on the day in that game, which was ultimately a knockout game, Japan were a better team. I think probably what the disappointing thing is that we didn't get to the level of performance. I believe that we've got more rugby. I believe that we've got the ability to be better than Japan on that day. But we didn't reach the consistent performances that then allowed us to go on and do it. Because as soon as it becomes knockout rugby, clearly, you know, it's 50-50. There's a opportunity for each team. If we had built towards that game in a stronger position, which is easy to say with hindsight, but if we were in a stronger position into it, then I reckon we would have more chance coming out the other end. We had some outstanding performances, some guys who have really stepped up, and then a lot of other guys who will be disappointed with the way it went, disappointed with personal performances, and clearly disappointed to come home before reaching the quarterfinals or beyond.
It's difficult, isn't it? You know, it's just as harsh as it sounds. Japan were better than us. They won the four games. Ireland beat us fair and square. We didn't perform anywhere near. And the frustrating thing is, we're better than what we showed against Ireland. So what you learn from a World Cup, for me, is really, and I don't have the answer to this, but you know, I know some people will and some people find the answer, it's what went wrong against Ireland. That's the learn that you have to take. And whether it's a psychological thing, whether it's a physical thing, whether it's a skill execution thing, whether it was just a perfect storm of, actually, Scotland started okay and found a bit of space inside the Irish Blitz defence, on the edge of the Blitz defence. And I'm saying for the first 5 minutes, we thought, wow, the first phase was something like 2.5 minutes long, which is unheard of against Ireland. You know, that it was quite good. But as soon as we conceded that first try, the performance fell. And that then, I say a perfect storm, you conceded another try quickly. And then before you know it, the rain comes on, you're chasing a game against a team who like to be ahead and are good at being ahead. And you're forced to take risks because you're so far ahead. So it's a wee bit perfect storm. But yeah, just that first game for me and understanding what went wrong is where the key lies for moving ahead.
Yeah, I agree with that. I think that's a point I was making as well, that it wasn't, let's not just look at the Japan game in isolation. We've got to look at what condition we were in performance-wise by the time we got there. And I suppose you've got to look at summer tests and that as well. And did we go into the World Cup in peak condition? Like, physically, I agree with Chris. Like, the guys are in great condition. Every team will be. So ultimately, it's disappointing to come home. I feel for the boys. Like, Chris and I, we've both been there. There's no lack of effort. There's no lack of will. They're out there giving absolutely everything. What we've got to find is that key to unlocking it, to make sure the consistent performances are there so that we are going into those games that we could/should win and getting the right results.
You mentioned you've been through 2011 was when you guys experienced that in New Zealand, and you know, as fans or people who work close with the team, you feel a certain way. But as players, you know, as two former captains, what does it feel like for you guys when that happens?
As low as a rugby moment I've had. The tournament itself in 2011, I mean, you know, it was ultimately, New Zealand is just crazy for rugby, and there was just so much noise, so many fans. It was phenomenal to be part of that. But we stuttered through the first two games a little bit and probably didn't have that performance that we needed to, a bit like we're talking about now, where we carried that consistency into the two bigger games for us, which were Argentina and England. And we went into that last England game a bit like we went into the Japan game. There was bonus points that were coming in, and we needed to make sure that we got five and England got nothing. And We ultimately weren't good enough. We didn't quite get there. We put absolutely everything out there, like the guys there against Japan, but we'd given ourselves too much to do because we hadn't been there before. But yeah, it was horrific. It really was. Chris and I were both hosting different events over there, and hearing how the fans are. And the fans, you know, I totally get it. Fans are spending money over there, watching back here, passionate about it as well. But some of the messages you could see coming into the players, I thought were great as well. You know, it's about being able to support the team even through the tough times, because ultimately you've got to have the trust that they have a good look back and make sure we get the most out of it. And we did that for 2011. And you've got to be honest. And the honesty factor is ultimately we weren't good enough in either tournament to make the quarterfinals. And then you've got to look at the why, and it's the why that's important. But
just one thing before we move on as well, like how they won't be that far off in 2011, and as crazy as it sounds, you're not far off. Like, everything's not wrong in 2019. Like, we got to a point just after half time against England in 2011 where we had to be 9 points ahead or more than 9 points ahead, and we got there. And there's one or two things, personal things as well. I missed a tackle against Argentina that in the lead up to one of the tries, it still kills me. And that's the fine line. Like, it's not as if you don't qualify, everything's wrong and nothing's right. And, you know, there's fine margins in it, one way or the other. And I mean, you can see that even with, say, Wales, France, quarterfinal. Like, Wales are probably the best team in the Northern Hemisphere, I think, of the last 5 or 6 years at winning games that they're meant to win, or winning games either they're meant to win, or they're under pressure to win, or they're underdogs. They just grind it out. But if you look at that quarterfinal, it was a pretty bad error from the French that allowed Wales back into it. So there's points in the game that it swings, but ultimately, you know, it's not all wrong. There'll be bits that are wrong. There'll be bits that were mistakes. There'll be bits that were well done. But it's the crucial ones you have to get right.
You mentioned Wales. They've now got the third place playoff against the All Blacks on Friday night. It's a bit of a weird game, I guess. Former players here, how do you get yourself kind of buoyed up for those kind of games? You've just been knocked out. You know you can't win it, but you've got to stay an extra week to play in a third place. Is it mentally, is that a challenge to get up for it, or because you're playing the All Blacks, or because you're playing for pride, is it quite easy to get up for it, do you think?
They don't have a different week, so they won't have a normal test week. The test week will, I would imagine, be slightly more laid back. And then ultimately they'll build it up from a shorter period. So it won't be like from the Monday out, just gradually building up. I think they'll almost forget about rugby for a few days and then go into the game. Ultimately they're representing their country. It's a match there'll be a lot of eyes on around the world. The other thing is I think Wales have made 9 changes. So there's a lot of fresh guys who haven't maybe had a huge amount of rugby at the World Cup will get the opportunity to put their best foot forward. And what is a big game, but also they'll be half an eye on what comes next as well. Like there's the Six Nations for them to be getting selected for. But I think the different week is key for it. It would be difficult to prepare for it the way you would prepare for, say, the final or the semi-final you've just been in. And that's up to Gatlin and his team. And from what I've already seen out coming out, I believe that's how Wales will do it. And the All Blacks, I would think, as well, because All Blacks will be getting it. They'll be getting it. If Wales make a World Cup final, it's an incredible story. Gatlin's already talking about punching above their weight. Everybody expected New Zealand to win or to make a World Cup final, or the vast majority did. Certainly everybody in New Zealand did. So the pressure on them is probably far greater than the pressure on the Welsh.
I'm going to have a wee bit of rant here.
Yes, here we go.
It's not really a rant. It is a wee bit of rant. I get frustrated. Now listen, I'm going to caveat it by saying I totally understand that you'd rather be in a World Cup final, right? Of course you would be. I get frustrated when the kind of narrative around the third, fourth place is a game that nobody wants to play in. Oh, I couldn't think of anything else. Why do you want to play in that? Like, totally wrong, in my opinion. You've got the opportunity to represent your country in a CAP international. Of course you're going to take it. And you've got the chance to be third. And I know everybody will shout and scream, oh, but it's no first, it's no gold. You know, nobody remembers who's second or third. I would rather be third than lose a quarterfinal or losing a pool stage or no qualify. Like, there's a brilliant opportunity for you to represent a country in a massive game. And I just really, I get frustrated at the kind of, you hear it all the time, and it's with, oh, the game nobody wants to play. Well, I'll play in it. I'll dig my boots and I'll play. Give me a short opportunity. Like, I just think it's a bit disrespectful to how much effort's gone in and what a game to play international rugby means if folk just say, oh, we'd rather go home.
Would you rename it?
I wouldn't care.
Doesn't matter to you.
Yeah, but it's what it is. You're playing for third and fourth. You could got a bronze medal match, caught a runners-up, whatever, but it doesn't matter. It's fact. You're playing for third. You're not good enough to be in the World Cup final, or you've not won the game to get in the World Cup final. How good can you then be is by being third rather than fourth, and you play for it. And it's frustrated me for a long time. Thanks for giving me the opportunity to defend, Jamie.
I'm glad I asked. Yeah, it's because there's been a lot of chat around that in social media.
And don't
media.
Get me wrong, I don't want to be third. You want to be first, like that's
yeah. But if you got if that you
if,
don't have the
if
opportunity
you're not good
to
enough
do that,
to be first or second, you want to be the best you can be, and that's being third.
No, I'm glad. I'm
who's going to win it?
New Zealand.
Yeah,
I think they'll win quite comfortably. I think Wales, as you say, made 9 changes. Their squad depth's not as good as the. I don't believe it's as good as the squad depth in New Zealand, and I think New Zealand, the team they've picked, arguably looks stronger in terms of, well, it is stronger in terms of experience than what played last week against England, and I think it looks pretty sharp team.
Yeah.
just on the All Blacks, England have been fined for the response to the hack. I know you guys have faced the hack a number of times. You ever done anything to combat it? Have you ever talked about it as leaders about what you could do or wanted to do? Or what's your thoughts on, you know, the challenge of the hack?
We kept our jackets on, I think. Kept our jackets on, so we stayed warm when they got cold. They didn't look overly cold. I think it's a brilliant part of the game. Adds theatre to it. I actually thought what was done to face it adds theatre to it as well. But I get there has to be rules. There's some great stories over the years of the Welsh, and then they refused to go out, so the New Zealanders did the haka in the dressing room, and they went out and absolutely scalped them. So. Yeah, it's kind of mixed whether you should do something different as far as what the results would show. I like it. I think it's a bit of theatre.
I like it. It's part of the game. Does it have an effect on the game? I'm not sure.
What's it like to face it for you, though? Does it faze you at all? The only thing
that kind of struck me the first time I faced it was quite loud. I don't know, it was louder than I thought it'd be. That's right. The only thing that faced me. And it's everybody will approach it differently. Some people will use it as to inspire themselves. Some people may shrink with what the challenge is. But I'm basically thinking, I really need to get into this game and I need to know what the first play is. I need to know if I'm taking the kickoff, where I'm putting it, what my techniques are like. And it's almost like you're watching it, you're facing it, you're respecting it. But my mind was on, how am I going to affect this game? And I don't know. I don't know how many players are affected by it positively or negatively compared to how many players just respect it, show it the respect it deserves, and then get on with your job. I was always kind of looking at the game more so than what was happening in that moment, because you couldn't affect it. It was a brilliant piece of culture, a brilliant piece of theatre, but my mind's on, am I going to kick the first goal and make the first tackle?
Where are you looking? I mean, do you find someone? Do you find your opposite number? What do you look around? Who do you look at? Who would you find the biggest guy, the smallest guy?
find your opposite number, and you try and use it as a positive. The danger is you face something like that, because it's a threat. That's maybe not the right word.
But
it's a challenge, isn't it? It's and how you face that and your emotions will have an effect on the next however long, but you've got to manage that, because it's really easy. Whether you're facing a hack or not, to be in any dressing room and get yourself up to the nines and your headbutting walls, and the first thing you do is run out and give away a penalty.
And drop the ball.
Yeah, or drop the ball, or, you know, slice a kickoff or whatever it is. So it's the control in rugby always between the emotions and the technical side of the game. And the hack undoubtedly adds an extra element to it for them as well. That's a dance where they have to be putting themselves out there. They have to be showing their emotions to the opposition. But then if the All Blacks have got to then calm down and make sure they're focusing that first minute of play.
It'll be different for everybody. Absolutely. You could ask every player who've ever faced it and you'd get a thousand different responses to that question as to what it means. Are you inspired? Are you nervous? Are you worried? Are you concerned? Are you no bothered? Are you doing keepy uppies at the corner flag like David Campese way back when, when he did it? And there'd be a million different responses, but I just think that for me, only talking personally, my mind was totally focused on the game and what was going to happen next rather than that moment. Respect it, but focus on the game.
The most intimidating one I've ever felt was not on the park. So we went, when I was 17, we toured New Zealand with the Scottish Schoolboys, and we went to King's College in Auckland, and it was meant to be a welcome for us. The whole school was out with the rugby team up the front. They played Bradley Meeker, who went on and played for the All Blacks.
Second row.
So he's standing. Didn't know clearly was Bradley Meeker at the time. He was just enormous. I mean, he was a foot taller than any of them, and Billy the side of the house. Toss in the schoolboys team. So he's faced off in front of me, but you're 20 metres away from him. I mean, he was literally, I could feel the spit hitting my face as I'm standing there, like, trying to look as tough as a 17 years old, fresh out of Bishop Briggs High School, staring at him. And it was almost to the point of being heated, because it felt physical, because he was right in my space. That whole tour we were billeted, so we didn't stay in hotels. We were billeted out, and I was billeted by him. So it was an interesting few days. But that when it's, as I say, when it was like an inch away from your face,
I can see that being more inspiring or intimidating. That's probably why they have a 10-metre rule.
Yeah.
Rule, isn't
it? He could easily
kick off. Because it could easily tee off, wouldn't
yeah.
it?
Well, we saw it with our Edinburgh coach, Cockers, when he got involved. He got right involved in their face, wasn't he? And him and the opposite number were in each other's faces. And
There's stories about that one after the game as well. We'll maybe leave that well.
Leave that for another one. But yeah, no, it's interesting to get your thoughts on the Hackoff, because obviously you guys have experienced it. And
I think sorry to interrupt again. I think we see it more now, obviously, because there's more televised games. New Zealand play more rugby. Like when I was growing up, if you saw the hack on TV, it was like, wow. And if you saw it in real life, it was even more wow. But I hope it doesn't lose its appeal, because you see it almost 12, 15 times a year. Mm. You know what I mean? And I mean to the viewer on TV, because it was like you knew about it, you heard about it, but having the experience of actually seeing it was pretty special. Now it's maybe too easy for us all to see it time and time again, and we do end up having discussions and chat about it. But no,
it's a fair point.
See it often.
Fair point. So yeah, Wales, New Zealand this Friday, and then the final on the Saturday. So England are there, South Africa are there. We've got to admit, England were brilliant, weren't they, against New Zealand?
Oh, incredible. All round game. Everything that could be said about them has been said this week. They've built it up incredibly well. They just performed to the best of their abilities and made New Zealand look average. Every talking point is, well, England grew down New Zealand poor. Well, England dominated the game and made New Zealand look poor purely because of their performance, I believe.
Yeah, England were really good, weren't they? Started off really well. They've actually got a wide game that caused Australia trouble in the early part of the game, or the whole game, but certainly the early part of the game the week before. And their wide game and the intensity and accuracy that it started with, I think, shocked the All Blacks to some extent. And then they were just, as you say, their defence, to me, became the strongest part of the performance. It was just incredible defence. Now, you know, afterwards you can look back and say, well, probably New Zealand should have kicked a bit more, but you can understand why they didn't, because they were sticking to the game that's won them pretty much every test match in the last 10 years by doing the same thing. But it just came up against the defence. It was just far better. And that's why I think guys like Ben Smith, who are playing this weekend in the wing, I think that those guys who had a bit more experience might have helped the backs, as I say, as a whole. So listen, we're actually playing it in our hands here, because their strength is defence and we keep running at it. So yeah, we'll see.
I was watching the game thinking there won't be a point where New Zealand are going to come back into it. Yeah. So when's it going to happen? When are New Zealand coming back into that? And it felt, I suppose, to your point there, New Zealand kind of did that as well. They just expected that they would come back into it, but they never really got that stuff. There was small moments, but England slammed the door. So I don't know. You talk about New Zealand's tactics within the game. As I say, I think the vast majority of that was dictated by what England did. But with hindsight, they should have done so. They had to do something different.
Yeah, I suppose even New Zealand's try was an England mistake, wasn't it? It didn't really come from anything. Mm. It was a line out, wasn't it? So we get a lot of Scotland, you know, in the press, we get a lot of stick for maybe not having a plan B at times. It was a similar case for New Zealand, or did they just have a game that...
Well, it's decision making on the field for me, that one. Like, their plan, every team has a plan B. Every team has a shape of game that you can go to that has options. And you can understand, that's what I said before, you can understand why New Zealand kept doing what they're doing, because, see, it's worked every other time. Like, they have actually broken the defence and broken through, but they just came up against a defence that wasn't going to be broken. I would imagine the players were thinking in the field, right, stick to systems, keep going, this is what will make us win, this is what's won us, that's all the experience we've got before, we're building towards this World Cup. And just England just matched it. And outmatched it, really, with their defence. So it would have been difficult for the players to say, right, let's kick more contestable kicks, or let's kick long and try and counter-attack off the second ball rather than the first ball, because it's not something they've had to do. It would have been in the structure, but I think the message on the field, probably for the leaders, would be stick to your system, keep doing what we're good at, what we know will work, but it wasn't good enough because England's defence was just exceptional.
Yeah, and it's difficult to, everybody talks about plans. It's not like you've got right, plan A, B and C written down on a bit of paper and you read it before you go out and think, right, we maybe move on to that one after 15 minutes. It's about actions out there and behaviours out there. It's very difficult to change things when the other team are in charge, the other team are controlling the game. You can say, right, guys, we're only going to go one pass for the next 5-10 minutes, but actually, again, you're just playing it in their hands because they're so strong. England are so strong around the breakdown.
And then on that, like to back up your point, if you say, right, we're only going to go one pass, what happens if there's a try? If you make two passes, three passes, are you just going to go one pass? Like, that's where plans are fluid, and game plans are structures really that allow the players to make decisions in the field rather than just blindly following a plan, like say a one pass play or keep it close. You have to scan for space and attack space.
Yeah, and the moment in the game, you mentioned it there, the moment it gave, probably the only moment, it was an England mistake, overthrow at the line out, process didn't go well and it was a simple try. That's the opportunity, because there's been a change in actions that New Zealand could then grab control back from England. But that's when England were at their best. That's when England said, no, that's not happening. We're still in control of this game. And whatever was said and behind the posts that led to England to go out and put in those actions in place was spot on. And you know, the leadership throughout the England team has been growing and growing. They've got a brilliant balance, like great balance to that back row. And Curry and Underhill in particular, like two young lads with not a huge amount of caps, have been standout players out the whole World Cup, like phenomenally good. And there's been this whole Ford Farrell debate and who's better, well. And, you know, I read something earlier in the week that, you know, Ford stepped out from outside Farrell's shadow, and he has massively. Like, you're now talking about him as an individual as opposed to talking about this combination all the time, because he's put in some brilliant performances over the World Cup. And, you know, there was a little bit of debate about whether he would play in this final because South Africa are likely to be more direct, and I'm delighted that he is, because he's earned the right to be there.
He's played well, isn't he?
And just on South Africa, what will they bring to the table in the final on Saturday?
Well, it's frustrating, isn't it?
One.
But, it's maybe not frustrating because it's working for them. But the you know, it's physical. It's six forwards on the bench that are even bigger than the guys that are playing, even more experienced. It's so attritional. It's so hard. But when you've got Cheslin Kolbe in your back three, you can't ignore him. He was unbelievable. He is unbelievable. I don't know, he's carrying an ankle knock, but
I think he might be back for the weekend.
He's back,
you know,
he's back. But like that quality that can single-handedly win a game has to, for me, be included in your strategy and your and the way you're going to try and play at some point. It would be quite, I don't know, you'd feel almost disappointed as a viewer, as a neutral, if he didn't get the ball, because it's just amazing to watch, and it's inspiring to watch, really. But I don't think he'll be any ball he gets will be probably kick returns. I don't think they'll, I might be wrong, but I don't think they'll go expansive in how they use the ball early on, especially.
I think they'll do what they've done. And when he does get the ball, it'll be dictated by the kicking game and the physicality. So it should be in the right areas, so he gets the opportunity to attack in England half. I think the biggest difficulty for South Africa is that they need to be a lot better, I believe, than they were in the semi-final. Now, if England can be the same, better, or even marginally worse, I still think England win it. So South Africa need, I believe, a slight point of difference. They were good for the first 20 minutes against Wales, and I felt as if they dropped away. If they can put that right through, sorry.
What you could do to get him into the game is put him at number 8. Get him picking up the base. If you're not going to go expansive, and if you've got a rock solid scrum, if you can get a rock solid scrum and defence are back five, and you'll be quick enough to get outside any back row, no matter how quick your back row is, I mean, this guy's electric, you could chuck him in the back of the scrum.
You got some inside information there?
No, I'm just thinking out loud.
You've seen that before, haven't you?
I've seen it from like when there's yellow cards against like a 7-man scrum, sometimes put a back and just to fly off. But like he could almost see him in that position with so much bulk in the front five. You know, like throw a curveball in and have him running across the field attacking defenders close to the line. It'd be pretty hard to stop.
I love it. I don't think it will happen, but I love it.
For some reason, I've got Bergamasco in my head. Did he not?
No, that's a whole different story. What happened? He started at scrum half.
That's right.
What was that
about?
Yeah.
Was that against us?
No, it was against England.
Yes, they wanted their 15 best players in the park and picked him at 9. And couldn't pass off his left hand. It just didn't work.
It was basically because I wanted to be direct as well.
It did not go to plan.
I'd get a hope and Chesham Colby at 8 and one or two scrums, not them all.
Yeah, yeah.
Would go a wee bit better than
start
that.
Start 9. I need to look that clip up because I remember it being pretty entertaining to watch. Yeah. But was it Marco Bergamasco?
Yeah.
9.
It was. I mean, it's been a few. It's been for Scotland. Richie Vernon capped it in the forwards and in the backs.
Yeah, that's right.
Rolly Reid capped in the forwards and in the backs. But row guys that could play, but had the speed and size to play out there. I can't think of anybody else that's done it. There's been you look at the current crop. There's plenty of converts, and Fraser Brown and Stuart McInally are both back rows that are now playing at hooker. You don't get many guys coming back the way from the front row. Maybe when you're in there, you're in there.
That's you for life. No, yeah, Bergamasco, blast from the past. What year was that then? Just so we can look it up. Do we know?
Oh, that's one for Chris. What? Oh,
what do you think, Chris?
I think it would be about 2007 ish.
Yeah, I was going to say 2009, but yeah, maybe slightly before.
Well, we'll find out.
It was England, Italy at Twickenham. Nick Mallett was the coach, South African coach. There's a criticism of the 10. I can't remember who the 10 was, maybe Ramiro Pez. He was too flat for a lot of the passes that went soaring over his head. He should have been
too short,
so he got binned. Look it up, guys. It's pretty entertaining. Let's move a little bit closer to home now, gents. The Pro 14's been kind of slowly happening in the background. Kind of a mixed bag for both teams. Edinburgh played 4-1-3, doing really well at the moment, with victory over Scarlets, Blues and Zebre. Glasgow looking to get back on track with played 4 and only 1-1. Look at Glasgow first. They've got Kings tomorrow night here at Scotstoun. What have you guys made of them in the Pro 14 so far?
A tough start for Glasgow. You mentioned it's kind of happening in the background. It's happening in the background because so many fans are focused on the World Cup. It's not in the background for players. It's a tough time. I think it's a good opportunity for guys to step up. And we've seen both at Glasgow and Edinburgh that some of the guys have grabbed that opportunity. For Glasgow, though, the Kings game on the Friday night, it's early to be saying these things, but it's getting close to the must-win game because it's not been a good start. There's guys coming back, Pete Horn coming back in. I think that's a key man to be able to drop back in, who can then help control that back line and bring in guys like Hugh Jones. I always feel, I think we've talked about it in a podcast, that Hugh's at his best when he's got a second distributor inside him, and that's what Pete is. So hopefully we'll see Hugh playing very well. But yeah, tough one, especially the Dragons result. It was a game that Glasgow had a team that was good enough to go down there and win. Credit to the Dragons. Dean Ryan's obviously had a good impact already down there. But yeah, Glasgow haven't had the start to the league campaign that they would want to have had.
Yeah, disappointing against the Dragons the weekend. Bit wet, windy, certainly very windy. That created a lot of turnover. I think it was like some 20 odd turnovers, which doesn't allow you to get your game going, which doesn't allow you to get in the rhythm, especially away from home, doesn't let you any control of the game really. So that's something that Glasgow will hope to put right this week, and I think they will. I think there's quite a lot of experience coming back, a few changes, and it's important for them to win the next two weekends of Kings at home and then Zebre away, which will be really important for them to get the quality team that they are up and running.
Sticking with you, Moss. Edinburgh, on the other hand, as I said, they've played 4 and they've won 3. They've got off to a pretty good start, haven't they?
Yeah, good. I think their game developed on Friday night. They played the Scarlets and Saturday night they played the Scarlets and played really well. The first couple of games that Edinburgh won, it was quite similar to how they won their blueprint for last year. Set piece, kicking game, good defence. And then they went away in Leinster and lost against a Leinster side but that scored a lot of points in a short period just after half time that kind of skewed the game a wee bit. But what was really encouraging about Edinburgh is how well they played on Saturday against a team that was unbeaten going into that in Scarlets. The defence was as good as ever, the set piece was as good as ever, and the tries they were scoring and their ability to move the ball to space and really have an attacking edge was excellent. So they have a tough nut to crack in Treviso at Benetton this weekend. The Italian players coming back make a big, big influence as well as the return of Scottish players for our team. So away over there, obviously Treviso made the playoffs last year, built on their home form. So it'll be another good challenge for Edinburgh.
It's great to see Mark Bennett back and playing so well. Mark,
doing well,
Mark Scott
yeah.
as well.
Five tries so far, Mark. Hat-trick week one and then scored week two and then scored again at the weekend.
So. He's a talented, talented rugby player. He's had so much bad luck, if you can call it that, with injury, that for him to get a run of games, I mean, he undoubtedly puts his hand up internationally as well, but it's good because he's playing well. Chris pointed out there, five tries, but he's... He's the type of guy that makes other people around about him play better as well when he's on that form, and I've been really pleased with the way he's played. Henry Purgus dropped back in. He's going to have a lot of competition in his hands this year, but he dropped back in and played very well against the Scarlets. And I agree with Chris. There was more to it. It wasn't just that blueprint from last year. There was more to it. There's probably a wee bit of freedom, a wee bit of confidence coming with the wins. So. Edinburgh in a very good place after the four games.
It's interesting when you look at both teams as well and what they're saying in the media. So I think yesterday Edinburgh were saying that it's going to be hard to implement the international players back into the squad again because Edinburgh are doing well, and I think Glasgow are saying, you know, we need Glasgow, the international boys are back, we can't wait to get them back out there. So two very different messages. Is that just purely because both teams are just in very different positions at the moment?
Different places. Edinburgh, it's a brilliant place to be. Like, the international boys need to come back and work their way back into a team. They're coming back into an environment where things are going well. It's a confident environment. Off the back of what's been a tough environment, certainly a tough finish for them. So you want your guys to come back in and not feel pressure. It's the best way for the international players to come back in and play well. That it's not all of a sudden, oh, thank goodness they're back, we've been needing them. Now, Glasgow have still got senior players who need to grab that. Callum Gibbons, Chris Fazzaro's of the world, who need to make sure that the players coming back are integrated in the right way. Dave Rennie's experienced in doing it now. But, yeah, I mean, Richard Cockrell is in a better place to integrate those players back in at his pace than probably Glasgow.
Finally, time for Super Six to officially launch next weekend. There's a few friendlies this weekend, but it's just great now that Super Six is finally going to get out there. We're going to get going and get this new brand of rugby out there.
It'll be really important for the players to get up and running. I think everybody in the playing group will of course be looking forward to it, but they'll be desperate to figure out how it feels, what it's like. They're desperate to win. Obviously, they have played against each other the last two or three weeks in different warm-up fixtures and 20 minutes and 30 minute games. A lot of preparation going in, and there'll be a lot of excitement. It's certainly building. Burramuir Bears against Stirling County on Friday night, the 8th, and then there's Southern Knights and Wiltonians on the Saturday, the 9th, and then obviously Ayrshire Bulls Heriot out at Millbrae on Sunday as the first weekend. And I think there'll be a lot of interest in it. I think there'll be a lot of people wondering what it's going to be like, no more so the players. You're condensing a number of players into fewer teams. Now, not everybody who's going to play Super Six or who's not going to play Super Six would be necessarily the best player. There'll be still good players that play in the club game. You can see that, and it's strong. But there's a Super Six, for me, allows an opportunity for those who want to develop, an avenue to try and develop. And those who are happy to play as best they can for the club and maybe have careers externally to their rugby career, that club scenario gives them the strength and the ability to excel there. So I think Super Six is a good thing. I think it'll be excellent in terms of a stepping stone. I think it'll take a wee while for us to understand the strengths of it because it's new, and the players are new, and there'll be one or two players probably surprised at how good it is. So maybe one or two players maybe thinking they can. It's maybe not quite as hard as I thought, but we'll find it soon enough.
I agree. I think it's brilliant. Also, for me, the game's been televised on the Sunday. Available on the BBC channels as well as our own channels.
Yep.
I believe that's brilliant. I mean, remember Rugby Special being on, and you're watching club players, and ultimately the Fuzzle Group are sits in that gap, but it gives the guys at a club on a Sunday the opportunity to see, you know, what is attainable as well. You know, I think, you know, you watch a pro game, it's brilliant, and we should absolutely push our young kids to be as good as they possibly can be. But what I like about it is making the kind of local hero element as well, that, you know, these guys can see that as a natural progression into a professional, a part-time professional game. I agree completely, it's been a long time building on and off the park, and like, I'm generally excited to see the product. It will take a while to build. It undoubtedly will, and it will get stronger and better. But yeah, I'm looking forward to watching the games this weekend.
And you mentioned Fosrock, they're obviously the sponsor of Super Six. I think you were involved in those discussions. You've been working with Fosrock for a while. How excited are they to be involved in this new tournament?
Yeah, we've got a launch on Monday, and Ian Watt, Chief Executive of Fosrock, will be there. They're the big supporters of Scottish rugby already in the Fosrock academies. And it's very much about the grassroots. It's about trying to bring through the next generation, and there's a natural fit between the Fosrock academies and the Fosrock Super Six. There'll be academy players playing in those games, but yeah, I mean, that's my world now. It's a commercial element. We can't do any of these things without the great support of these businesses, and Fosrock Ian in particular has been a fantastic supporter of us.
You heard my idea for a man of the match. Instead of getting a medal, I think it should be a gold hard hat.
Fosrock gold hard hat.
I think that would be.
He generally thinks this is his best idea he's ever had.
I've got other ones as well, which I won't disclose because people will steal them. Well, actually, I'm going to say it because it's not going to happen. For the winter months, an As onesie.
An As onesie?
Yeah, so a Scottish onesie, but it's an As onesie. I took it to retail, but they laughed me out of the room.
You writing some of these ideas down? You shouldn't just keep them in your head.
I've just put them out there, so they're either going to get stolen or out laughed there, at. So. Yep. But golden hard hat, would you wear one?
When?
If you got man of the match.
Why?
would you wear a medal if you got a medal?
No.
Would you not?
No.
You'd wear a medal, Al. There's a photo behind us of you wearing a medal in the Guinness Pro 12 final where was that? Ulster.
The only thing missing from that picture is a hard hat.
Exactly. Imagine you with a hard hat on. A gold hard hat with Fosrock on it. You'd remember that, wouldn't you? I'll take it to Fosrock.
I'm a wee bit kind of speechless. Why a hard hat?
Fosrock.
I know.
Because Fosrock. Everyone gets medals these days. You need to be a bit different. Fosrock, golden hard hat.
The biggest thing, cement. What about a gold bag of cement with that?
Yeah, if it works. If you remember it, you know, it's a way of going, oh, there's that guy walking down the street. He must have been man of the match.
So they wear it to what?
Yeah, of course you do.
Wear it to what? Wear it to training.
Wear it for a week and hand it back.
Exactly. I think you'd be able to keep it.
Put the mantelpiece for a week and
take
hand it
back. Take it to Fosrock, see what they say.
We'll take it to Fosrock.
It's not a cracking idea.
And if anyone wants to help me with the As onesies, then.
I think this is a feature. I think we could have Jamie's bright ideas.
I think the As onesies got more legs than the gold hard hat.
More legs, very good. Very good. A couple of legs in that.
That's pretty much all from us this week. One more thing to mention, though, is that Scotland women, they return as well for their first ever autumn test campaign. They're against Wales on the 17th of November and against Japan on the 24th of November. Both games are here at Scots. And if you want to get more information on those games, head over to scottishrugby.org. But we'll be talking about them when the team selections are announced in the couple of weeks. Cheers, gents.
Bye-bye. Cheers, Jamie.
That's all from us this week on the official Scottish Rugby podcast. Thank you very much for listening. We'll be back next week with more exclusive content in and around Scottish Rugby.